Christianity is inherently persuasive. In its view of the world's origins, problems, and solution, we think we know what's best for everyone else. Not necessarily as it sounds out of arrogance, though certainly we do sometimes sound that way to others, but out of love in a way that's consistent with what we believe to be God's intent for this world. We're asking others to trust us and to ultimately trust God, but what we believe brings liberation, others actually perceive as intolerable restraints. So we can benefit from others who offer insight into the human mind and motivations. My name is Colin Hansen. I serve as the editorial director for the Gospel Coalition, and I'm pleased today to be joined by Jonathan Haidt. He's the author of a new book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. He serves as a social psychologist at the NYU Stern School of Business. He was a professor at the University of Virginia from 1995 until 2011. Professor Haidt, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure, Colin. Very nice to be here.
Great. Well, this book was really helpful to me in so many different ways, and we've got a lot of ground to cover. It's a book that I hope many people will pick up and really, you know, take pen to paper and try to, you know, sometimes learn from you, obviously, sometimes argue back and forth, and hopefully that'll be some of the dynamic we capture here. And one of the issues that we often come across, Christians, we study the great Enlightenment critiques of religion and learn to defend the faith with carefully constructed apologetic arguments, but you seem to indicate that such focus on reason might be misplaced. You write in The Righteous Mind, "Keep your eye on the intuitions and don't take people's moral arguments at face value. They're mostly post hoc constructions made up on the fly, crafted to advance one or more strategic objectives." Later, you write, "If you want to change people's minds, you've got to talk to their elephants." What do you mean by this?
So I'm a social psychologist, and in studying the mind and how we're influenced by people around us, the general view in social psychology is that most of what happens in our minds is automatic, unconscious, not quite the way Freud said. It's not deep, dark, evil stuff. It's just that most of our mind is automatic processes, and that's what I mean by the rider. The metaphor that I developed in my last book, The Happiness Hypothesis, is that the mind is divided like a rider on an elephant, where the rider is our conscious reasoning. That's about 1% of what's going on in our heads at any given time. And the other 99% is the elephant. You could think of it like a horse and rider, but, you know, an elephant's a lot bigger and a lot smarter than a horse. You know, when was it St. Paul who said, "The flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, that you cannot do the things ye would"? Well, that's a recognition that you can't just consciously will things and make them happen. Something up there is resisting.
Yeah. Well, tell us more about these intuitions. Why do we perceive people as being primarily rational creatures that we can argue into agreement with us?
Well, we all think that we are rational. We think that we have good reasons for our positions. We often think that we came to them of our own free will. And we extend that courtesy to others. Then we give them arguments, and we find that they don't listen to us. And then we often distrust them. We think, oh, well, they must not be sincere. They must have some hidden motive. They're unreasonable. But the truth is that we're all basically like lawyers. That is, our reasoning is much more like a lawyer who's trying to construct the best case he can than it is like the ideal scientist or judge who is weighing the evidence on both sides. This is just human nature, and there are evolutionary explanations for this. I'm sure there are theological explanations for why we might be this way. But whatever your theory of origins, most listeners here, I think we'll agree that when they've tried to convince people on major religious or moral or political questions, their arguments have fallen on deaf ears.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this persuasion. I was convicted reading your book by some simple advice that you borrow from Dale Carnegie. I'll run through a little bit of it. You say, borrowing from Carnegie, "To avoid direct confrontation, begin your discussion in a friendly way. Smile. Be a good listener. Never say you're wrong. Find common ground to build trust, and praise this person you disagree with before you ultimately disagree. You then summarize, saying the persuader's goal should be to convey respect, warmth, and an openness to dialogue before stating one's own case. Why do you think this is so hard for us?
We are very good, very practiced at making arguments. We jump into it right away, and we do this in part to impress others with how smart we are. But if we really want to change people's minds, I think we would take much more indirect routes. Let me just give you an example. Let's take Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. This is supposed to be an argument to sort of buck up atheists and get them to the courage to stand up, but he's also trying to persuade religious believers that there's no God and that religion is terrible, stupid, and evil. I don't know how many religious believers he ever persuaded, but he starts off basically saying that God as portrayed is a terrible, evil, cruel beast, and I'm going to prove to you that he doesn't exist. Now, that's not a very good way to start. It's not a very good way to convert people. Here's another way. When I used to teach a class in moral psychology at the University of Virginia, and one of the assignments in the class was you have to do some moral field work. You have to go to an organization or spend some time with people that you disagree with, that they're very different from you, and act like an anthropologist. Just be among them, listen to them, observe them, and try to explain how they see the world and explain it sympathetically. So what typically happens is the students, the atheist students will choose to go to an evangelical church, and the conservative students will go to a feminist meeting, something like that. Well, it's happened a number of times that students who go to church, and I did this myself. I mean, I was, raised Jewish. I'm an atheist, but I did it myself. I went to I forget which denomination it was in Charlottesville. At any rate, a very conservative church. And everyone who goes reports being just surrounded by love, and it's a wonderful experience. And I had one student the last year I did this, basically start going to that church. I mean, they didn't convince her with arguments, they didn't convince her with logic, but she felt such warmth and welcoming that she was able. It opened her heart, and when you open your heart, that opens your mind, and then she could listen. They could talk.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting. When we're going after somebody, primarily, again, see them as a brain, but really you're talking about appealing to the heart in ways that just to understand that. I thought it was interesting just to kind of reason backward from the heart to the reason, to essentially say we have motivations that we don't really understand. We're groupish in our thinking.
That's right.
And talk about that groupish dynamic.
Yeah. In the book, I give an evolutionary story about how we evolved, not just as individuals, but as groups that were competing with groups. Now, many of your listeners may not want to go with me on the evolutionary story, but we can all agree, I think, that to be human is to have these feelings of longing for connection. And to discover that when you get to participate in a group that trusts each other, that loves each other, that works together, it's thrilling. It is uplifting. It's among the best experiences in life. And so we all can wonder about that. And I think this is much of the impulse behind religions of all sorts, and certainly behind Christianity. I was raised Jewish. I went to synagogue, and synagogue is often very cerebral. It's reading from the Torah. And the few times that I've been to Christian services, of course they vary tremendously, but they seem much like the music is better. There's more positive emotion, mm-hmm. And so I think Christianity, Christian denominations often do an extremely good job of satisfying this longing to be part of something larger. I don't know if that's what you mean by communion, but this is just a basic human need, and I think religion addresses it.
Yeah, one way Christians will often talk about this is people feeling a sense of belonging before it's followed by believing. And, different people...
That's perfect.
Yeah,
yep, come that's in, just what I'm talking
in,
about.
Yeah, come in different ways, but different people will come to Christianity. Some, it is cerebral, but for many others, it's certainly through the introduction of a friend, a family member, and just knowing somebody who believes this can be a profoundly revolutionary experience for people who are not commonly surrounded by other Christians. You know, you really exactly. believe this stuff? You, of all people, you seem so normal. It's a fairly common yep. thing for Christians to hear, especially in, you know, places like where you live in New York City and some others around the country.
That's right. So, I mean, we can formulate a new little dictum right here from what you said, which is that relationships are more powerful than reasons. Yeah. Relationships open the heart. Reasons don't. Yeah. So, yes, I agree. Our relationships can get us to see things, because if it's somebody that we trust, we're willing to listen to. But when we have political arguments with people that we don't really trust, don't really know, they just don't lead anywhere. They're just knocking heads together.
I think you described the internet right there. All of it. Right there.
Oh, that's right. Oh, my God. The discussions, the comments after blog entries, oh, they're just ridiculous.
As an extreme example of that, facilitated by modern technology. Well, let's talk about one of the areas that's most controversial today and where Christians seem to run into the most problems when they're trying to persuade others. You say something in The Righteous Mind that Christians know but struggle to explain. Comes right away on page 4. Some actions are wrong, even though they don't hurt anyone. Explain how Western societies came to limit morality to harm and label everything else as mere social conventions.
That's right. That is one of the great changes of modernity. I'm a social psychologist, and I started doing my research across cultures and working with anthropologists, especially an anthropologist named Richard Schwader. And one thing that I learned is that almost every human society believes in moral truth. They believe there is a moral order, and they think that it is the job of each person to get in harmony with that moral order. Now, when you start getting diversity and you get rising wealth and rising individualism, as happens in Europe after the Enlightenment and then the Industrial Revolution, you get this problem that you get people living together who believe in different moral orders. And there were all kinds of clashes and conflicts between religious denominations, and there evolved a desire for tolerance, for just, okay, you worship the way you want, I'll worship the way I want. Along with this, you get ever-increasing wealth and ever-increasing individualism. The virtue of tolerance keeps rising and rising and rising, and the moral domain shrinks and shrinks and shrinks down to the bare minimum, which is, you don't interfere with me, I won't interfere with you, and then we can all get along. Now, what happens then is you get the rise of moral relativism. You get people who say, well, there is no moral truth. How could there be if we all think that there are different moral truths? And then this gets taken up by the modern left-right split. In other words, the culture war in America that's been going on, especially since the 1990s, is in fact precisely over this issue. There's a wonderful book by James Hunter, a conservative sociologist at the University of Virginia, called Culture Wars. And he says that American history used to be, you know, Protestants versus Catholics and various other splits like that. But beginning in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it becomes more the what he calls the Orthodox members of each religion, including Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, the Orthodox who believe that there is an objective moral order given by God, and those the liberals in each of those religions who do not think so, who think that moral truth must be invented by each generation as it sees fit. And so this issue of relativism is very much the dividing line right now between left and right, and this explains why religion in America now is very much associated with the right, with conservatism, whereas 30, 40 years ago there was no such split.
Well, this from a Christian perspective, this new tolerance or this moral relativism does not feel particularly tolerant and seems to be particularly judgmental in certain ways. And obviously, sexuality is one of those places that's come to the fore. So, I mean, is this, I think a lot of Christians just think this is a blind spot for people on the other side. But as you've been pointing out, it's not, it's, you just fall into the same judgmentalism, and you're not exactly going to persuade people by coming forward and saying, you pretend to be tolerant, but look how intolerant you are. How can Christians help others to see, you know, you say you're a relativist, but you obviously are very judgmental in certain ways. You say you're tolerant, yeah. but you're very intolerant toward people who disagree with you. on these things.
That's right. So first, the way you put it, it's like it's a blind spot on the left. I think that's exactly right. A dictum of my book is morality binds and blinds. Another way that I sometimes say it is follow the sacredness, and around it you'll find a ring of motivated ignorance. That is, if you know what a group holds sacred, that means that the group unites around it. It binds them together to share a belief in something sacred, but then they can't really discuss it openly and realistically. And so it's easy for secular folk to say, oh, well, you know, they worship Jesus and they hold the Bible sacred and they can't question the Bible and they're so ignorant. But once you hold tolerance sacred, then you circle around that, and you can't think clearly about tolerance anymore. And you think, well, you know, we hate intolerant people, and we're not going to tolerate intolerant people, and all Christians are intolerant. And it is very much like a religion. It is a religion in the worst sense, that is, a sort of a fundamentalist religion. So I think you're exactly right that that on the secular left, you do get something approaching a kind of a religious devotion to an ideal, which makes them quite close-minded and intolerant. I'm facing this issue in my own field, in social psychology, and in many of the social sciences, where there's a sort of a secular liberal moral order, and conservatives and religious people often feel unwelcome. I'm trying to convince my colleagues that this is a form of discrimination, and it's very difficult to make the case. I think that I've lined up all the evidence, but it's kind of hard to persuade people with evidence alone.
Well,
I think humble. Oh, go ahead.
Continue. Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I think one of the great strengths that I think that Christians have, one of the great virtues on which they are experts, is humility and just bearing discrimination, bearing criticism humbly. And this has gotten through to me. I grew up really not encountering many evangelical Christians, but at the University of Virginia, many of my students were. Many of the students come from rural Virginia with religious backgrounds, and many of them were just so humble and sweet. And I think responding, you know, as with some of the early civil rights, you know, the black students who integrated the schools, you know, they didn't fight back. They just behaved with dignity and humility. And eventually their example did persuade some people. So that might be one way. But, boy, that could take a long time.
Right. Well, certainly, I think a lot of Christians would recognize in that the way of Jesus himself against his critics. And also, in some ways, simply the command to do good deeds and to let those good deeds shine and to see, let others to see, and an expectation of criticism. That's what Jesus taught Christians to expect, that they would be hated in some ways, but to love their enemies in that. The love part, that's hard to do. That is hard to do. Well, how big a factor in these disagreements and misunderstanding is geographic sorting along political and religious lines? You mentioned just at the University of Virginia some of that rural and suburban-urban divide. And interestingly, you write in The Righteous Mind, the main way that we change our minds on moral issues is by interacting with other people. When discussions are hostile, the odds of change are slight. You might say then that we change others' minds by our proximity to them. I mean, it's going to be hard to change somebody else's mind if you're not around them. Certainly, I think that's a fairly conservative critique of a lot of what we see in the media. If you're working as a journalist in Manhattan, your odds of ever encountering somebody who doesn't agree with you on sexual ethics or religion is slight in some ways.
That's right.
So,
that is what has happened to us. There are many causes of our rising polarization and political dysfunction in the country. There are a lot of different causes, but one of them is definitely the process that you mentioned. There's a book by Bill Bishop called The Big Sort, and it refers to the fact that in the post-war world, after World War II, as you get again, you get rising wealth, rising individualism, rising freedom. People don't just stay where they were born. They decide, well, I would like to live in the Pacific Northwest, and oh, well, I'd like to move to the big city. So people move to the place that is most congenial to them, that has the job that they want. And as a consequence, we've moved into what some sociologists call lifestyle enclaves. So it's not just geographic proximity. It's all the ways that you move, all the places you go, all the things that you read. So people who share a similar personality will tend to have similar beliefs, and they will tend to read the same magazines. They will tend to live in the same kinds of communities. So central cities are now becoming all liberal, whereas the exurbs, the suburbs are mixed, but the exurbs, the more distant communities from the cities, are more conservative. The rural areas are conservative. And this means that since we have fewer and fewer friendships across party lines, that makes it even ever harder for us to understand each other. It's a big problem in our country. The view that I take, that I came to in my book, is that liberal and conservative are like yin and yang. They are both expert on certain things. We need the wisdom of both sides. This actually grows out of the conclusion I reached in the happiness hypothesis, which is that if you really want to know the truth, the best place, the place you most need to look, is in the minds of those who disagree with you, is the minds of your opponents, because they're wise to whole areas of human experience and threats to human society that you don't even think about, that you don't even know about or worry about. So it is a problem for us that I would say, in fact, that we're getting less and less wise as we become more and more segregated morally.
Yeah, and interestingly, for Christians, it's not an option to be segregated with the command and the privilege that we've been given to share the gospel with the nations. And also, I think you see there has been a big movement of Christians in places like New York City and elsewhere to move into the center cities, recognizing, one, that we've been failing to influence them, and then secondly, that we've been failing to learn from what's happening there and learn from people who disagree with us. So that's an interesting process. We'll see how that shakes out. You argue also in the book that our public policy should make sure that everyone's reputation is on the line all the time. So bad behavior always brings bad consequences. But along with this big sort, we also see we live in a radically individualistic age in a lot of ways. So how do you implement that strategy of accountability when so many live in urban and suburban areas where they don't know their neighbors, let alone their politicians and public officials? And this, you had a quote in the book from Robert Putnam, the distinguished sociologist. It was pretty disturbing, I thought. It said that diversity seems to trigger not in-group, out-group division, but enmity and social isolation. In colloquial language, people living in ethnically diverse settings appear to hunker down, that is, to pull in like a turtle. If we're going to have accountability, you have to have, people have to be able to live together. How do you live together in these increasingly diverse and individualistic settings?
That's right. Some of that this is a big problem. Some of this is irreversible. We're not going to ever go back to the tight communities of medieval Europe or even of the 1920s, 30s, or 50s, whichever decade you want to point back to. There is one big thing that we can do, which is very controversial, and I've come to this only reluctantly, but I think cutting way back on immigration the bottom line is that diversity, which has become an icon of the left, I think has a profile of effect that is to some extent negative, and that's the point of Putnam's quote. That is that when people feel that everyone around them is like them, speaks their language, shares their values, they're more trusting, they'll contribute more to local community groups and efforts, whereas when they feel that everyone around them is different, they just kind of hunker down, they focus in on themselves and their families. They're less good public citizens. Now, my grandparents came here from Russia and Poland in the great wave of immigration of the 1890s and early 20th century. It was a time when many Americans thought there was way too much immigration, and, you know, frankly, they were right. America then shut the doors, didn't allow in any immigrants, which I think was too much. But one thing that political scientists have noticed is that in the decades after immigration was reduced, it gave the country time to assimilate all these Jews and Italians and Irish people and people who'd come from all over the world. It gave them a few decades to all become Americans. And then we went through the war together, World War II especially, together. And it really gave us really our glory days, our days as a much more united nation with very, very strong social capital, very good institutions. And then in the 60s, immigration is loosened again, and we get very, very, very high rates of immigration, I think around as high as they were 100, 130 years ago. And we get rising polarization, we get decreasing trust. So I don't think we should shut off immigration, but I do think that conservatives are right to worry that immigration has a variety of negative effects, and I'd love to see it not reduced drastically, but at least slowed down and converted over to just legal immigration. I think we should do something to reduce illegal immigration and get more control of the immigration policy. Now, that would anger people on the left, where I think that diversity and tolerance and immigration are all bound up together. But I think this is part and parcel of recognizing that, you know what, we need to work to create the sense that we live in a shared moral community, that we're going to have our differences, you know, Christians and Jews and Muslims and secular folks. We're going to have our differences. But I think we have to work to maximize what little we can do to feel that we share a community. I think our common language, our common history, including reverence for the founding fathers, I think there are a number of conservative ideas that I, as a centrist, a former liberal but now centrist, that I think are really quite valuable.
Yeah, it's an area of pretty significant disagreement among Christians, and it tends to break in large part along ethnic and, not surprisingly, also regional lines. Christians in the Midwest and the Southwest and the South being a little more concerned, well, more white and more concerned about immigration. But then in places like Boston and New York, immigration since the 60s has been a key factor in revitalizing Christian denominations on the coasts and in the cities. And so it's an area where we continue to have a lot of questions and a lot of problems, but not a lot of answers, because despite the fact that Christians ought to have a common shared moral foundation, a shared history and story together as believers, as told in Scripture, it's still difficult to implement in reality. Speaking in relation, I thought your book was so helpful in just talking about the importance of relationships, something we can't emphasize enough, I think, against the spirit of this age. And I think Christians could largely agree with your statement when you write, happiness comes from between. It comes from getting the right relationships between yourself and others, yourself and your work, yourself and something larger than yourself. Of course, Christians would want to say, identify God as that transcendent being revealed in Jesus Christ. But where do you see Westerners tend to think they can find happiness instead of the way you counsel them to find happiness?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's one of the puzzles of the modern age. As we get richer and richer, we don't really get happier. Mm-hmm. Now, it is true that the secular Western nations of you know, Northern and Western Europe are the happiest countries on earth. So people can be happy, nations can be happy without being particularly religious. But in the United States, at least, the data show pretty clearly that religious people are happier than non-religious people. And I think it's for exactly the reason, I mean, the quotation that you gave, that was my attempt to summarize what I learned in the happiness hypothesis. I think that people who are members of a healthy Christian denomination or any religious denomination, they have all three ingredients: get the right relationship between yourself and others, that you know, a community, yourself and your work, and yourself and something larger than yourself. So not just a community, but a community that has the sense that it is either pursuing noble ends or in touch with noble and uplifting truths. And religion and devotion to God is the quintessential or the original source of that higher satisfaction. Many people can find it in pursuing a political cause, or in the arts or the sciences, or having something which they feel is a calling. But I think in many ways these modern attempts to pursue happiness are substitutes for the kind of happiness that is found in religious communities, which I think, you know, I'm telling an evolutionary story about it here, but I think in the sense that we evolved to be religious, as I argue in the book, we evolved to be religious. And when people leave religion, they often don't leave all religion, they just leave organized religion, and they pursue other activities in a kind of a quasi-religious way.
Hmm. Well, just one of the summarizing thoughts here. You summarize your evolutionary analysis to say that angry gods make shame more effective as a means of social control. One thing, I didn't see any trace of the Christian concept of grace in your book, that we can love others because God in Christ first loved us. And that's essentially, I mean, that's what Christian pastors and other leaders are focusing on a week-to-week basis in their preaching, following the example of Jesus, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbors as yourself. So I wondered, do you see grace as making any difference in the issues that you raise in the righteous mind?
Yes, I don't fully understand the concept of grace, but I do think in general that to get a healthy moral community, a community that suppresses selfishness and allows people to work together, trust each other, and therefore flourish, you need to use all of the available moral buttons, all of the available moral mechanisms. And so shame on the negative side, if people, as we talked about earlier, if people are always concerned about their reputation, if everyone who sees them knows other people who knows other people who knows them, so shame is a negative moral emotional button, but it's very powerful. And then love and the sense of inclusion is another very positive moral emotional mechanism. So I would think that a healthy community would use both, that you would be ashamed to be caught letting or failing in your responsibilities, failing in your duties, letting others down, behaving selfishly. But at the same time, you value what others think of you so much, in part because you love them and you feel included in the community of love. So I think, you know, as every parent knows, when you're trying to get your kids to turn out right and trying to get them to behave right, it's a real challenge. And you've got the carrot and the stick. You've got the shame and the love and the praise. You've got all kinds of tools. And if you simply give up one of them, as often is done in more liberal households, generally there's a reluctance to punish, a reluctance mm-hmm. to use shaming. They try to rely more on just the positives. And I think that makes it harder. I would just close by directing listeners to the webpage for the book, righteousmind.com, where they can read introductory chapter, see a variety of videos, and especially there's a tab called Applying Moral Psychology, where I have a page on comments and essays and blog posts that religious readers have written, some pointing out some things that I fail to understand basically just raising issues that I think will be of interest to religious readers. So thank you.
Thank you, Professor Haidt, for joining us today to discuss your book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. I'm Colin Hansen for the Gospel Coalition.